Our text this morning is from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. I'm going to read that, then I'm going to go back to the Old Testament to give the historical context for this verse. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, begins with a question. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. Now, to understand this verse, I think, properly, we need to go back to the book of Judges. I'm turning back to Judges chapter 6, and I'm going to read all the first six verses of Judges chapter 6. Here's what is written. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. You know, after reading that paragraph and thinking about the problems that we've got to deal with, we've kind of got it easy. We live on easy street compared to what the Israelites were having to deal with for 7 years. And I think there's symbolism in that number seven. Because God is trying to do something with Israel, and He's going to stay with them until the job's done. For 7 years, the enemies of Israel had been engaged in a scorched earth policy against Israel. They had driven the Israelites out of their homes. The Israelites had gone to the mountains. That's where refugees typically go when they're looking for safety. And having left their homes, they were reduced to living in dens and caves and any sort of fortified rock position they could find up there in the mountains. They would go down and plant crops in the fields, but when the crops came up, the enemy would come back and destroy all the crops. They'd lost their home, they had lost their food supply, starvation was undoubtedly widespread, and there wasn't much the Israelites could do about it. Their enemies were as numerous as locusts, bent on a policy of total destruction. And in verse 12 of Judges 6, there's a man who is mentioned in Hebrews 11:32 by the name of Gideon. And he asked the question that people ask during tough times. His question is, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? If God loves us, if God is on our side, how can He be allowing all of this to happen? Have you ever thought about what God was doing during the 7 years that He allowed Israel to suffer like this? I think one thing He probably did every day during those 7 years was to cry. If you don't imagine God as a being capable of tears, of crying, of weeping, you don't believe in the same God that I read about in my Bible. Christ wept. In Luke 19, when Christ was going to Jerusalem for the last time, when He came over the Mount of Olives there and saw the city spread out before Him, the text says that He just broke down. He cried and cried and cried because of what He was going to have to do. He was going to have to punish the Jews. Judgment was coming to the Jews, and when Christ thought about it, the man of sorrows was reduced to tears. I suspect Christ and God cried before the walls of Jericho fell. God loved the Jerichoites as much as He loved the Israelites. And I think whenever God has to move, in severity. I said in the class today, sometimes the greatest kindness a parent can show his child is to be severe. But I think whenever God has to administer a spanking, it's like the father sometimes tells the child, this is going to hurt me more than it hurt you. And Gideon wants to know, why is all this happening? I'll tell you why. It's because God hates things we don't give a second thought about. There are things we do, things we engage in that are wrong and ungodly and against the will of God, and we never even think about them, but God hates them. And because He hates them, because He hates seeing them in us, He's going to use every tool within the divine toolbox to drive those things out of us. Many times we don't care if we're good or bad. But God always cares. And in His love, He's willing to resort to things. You know, there are parents who would rather their children be wicked than feel pain at bearing the consequences of their wickedness. They would rather have a bad child than have to spank a child. And the child endure that pain. That's not God. And God, for 7 years, has been spanking Israel. And finally, Israel says, Father, we're sorry. And when they said that, God is ready to call off the dogs. And that's what Hebrews 11:32 is talking about. Hebrews 11:32 is talking about men that God raised up as deliverers. God is a God who delivers. In 1 John chapter 5, we've not gotten to this passage yet in our Sunday morning studies, but in 1 John chapter 5, verse 4, John says, this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. Paul in Romans 8 says, we are more than conquerors. Paul and John were writing to little groups of believers scattered around in the countryside, in small town, small congregations, humble people, very much like this group here. No power, no clout, no political leverage we can use. And we are believers who are living in a very hostile environment. Gibson City is hostile to Christianity. Much about Gibson City is utterly incompatible with Christianity. The Christians of the New Testament era were persecuted because they lived in a hostile environment. They were condemned as lawbreakers. They were called atheists because they wouldn't acknowledge the gods of the Romans, the gods of the Greeks. The governments at that time were run by Jeffrey Epstein's, just like our government is today. There was depravity. There was perversity. There was unnameable vices and cruelty. And that's what we've come to in our society today. It was a tough time to be alive. And there are six individuals in one group in verse 32. And the number seven, remember, that's the number of completeness. That's the number that gets the job done. Seven individuals. Four of them are judges. The first named is Gideon. One is a prophet Samuel. One is a king David. And then the prophets, a collective term, who were raised up by God during troubled times, during tough times, to lead Israel back to Him. And so, verse 32 is a study of people during troubled times. I think we're in very troubled times in this country. Further, I think we are past the point of solving the problem ourselves. I don't think we have enough votes. I don't think we have enough billionaires giving money to our cause. I don't think we have enough people embedded in positions of influence. And you're welcome to disagree with me, but my own idea is our ability to fix the mess we've allowed to arise is gone. We're past that point. And that was the Israelites in Judges chapter 6. They couldn't fix the problem. What do we do in tough times when we can't fix the problem? Well, verse 32 is going to help us. Well, let me point out something. Verses 30 and 31 were talking about the greatest generation. Verse 32 was talking about the baby boomers. Our greatest generation was that generation that went and fought the Great War and dealt with evil men, saved our way of life. That generation's gone. It was followed by the baby boomer generation, of which I'm one. And the baby boomer generation just made a mess of everything. Our generation has allowed us to go from Eisenhower in the 50s, you know, victory in 1945, to where we are today. And we have no one to blame but ourselves. And so when we're in a generation that's allowed society to deteriorate, we're living in the dark ages right now. We have returned to the dark ages. Things go on in our society, regularly going on, atrocities, abominations. You'd have to go back to pagan times to find anything comparable. The Dark Ages, which historically were from about the 5th to 10th century, were characterized by a couple of things. The first is that there was a decline in learning and a decline in the culture. I Googled the other day and found out that high school reading scores in the United States are at historic lows. A decline in learning and a decline in culture. If you want to see how far we've fallen, watch the halftime of the Super Bowl today. You'll get a pretty good idea of where this culture is. And that's the way it was in the book of Judges. We've got four men mentioned from the book of Judges. The book of Judges was a terrible period for this reason. Four times we're told there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And when you're in a group of people, when you're in a nation where everybody thinks he is his own God, he knows the right way to go, he knows what needs to be done, you have set the stage for a societal catastrophe. So I want to talk about 3 points from Hebrews 11, 32. I want to talk about the times in which we live, followed by the trust which we need for the times in which we live, followed by the triumph we can expect if we show the kind of trust we need in the times in which we live. So, the tragedy, the times, the trust, and the triumph. Let's begin by talking about the times in which we live. I read about the times in which Gideon lived. I want to give you a picture of the times in which we live. And the best way to do that is to ask you to turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Because Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 3 nails it. He exactly describes the dark times in which we live. Let me begin reading with verse 1, 2 Timothy 3. Paul says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." Now, the last days is a biblical idiom that refers to the time in which we live, since the cross. From the prophetic standpoint, the last days would be that era of earth history following the cross. Hebrews 1:1, "God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in times past to the fathers, to the prophets, hath in these last days," in these last times, "spoken unto us by His Son." Paul says, here's the way it's going to be in the last times, in this era in which we live. And he uses a word, and this is the only place in the Bible where the English word occurs. Paul says that in the last days, perilous times will come. That's the only place that English word is used. Perilous. But the Greek word that is translated perilous is used in one other place. It's used over in Mark chapter 8, I believe, where Christ comes upon two men living in the tombs, possessed by demons. And in Mark 8:28, the text says of them that they were fierce. The Greek word means savage. They were a threat to people because they were demonized. They were possessed with demons. That's the word Paul uses in 2 Timothy 3:1. We live in demonic times. Now that doesn't mean people are demon possessed now like they were then. Doesn't mean that at all. But it means the same effects are seen now that was seen in someone possessed by a demon back then. This is the picture of a demon that Paul paints in 2 Timothy 3, and this is the picture of the times in which we live. And we're going to go through each characteristic he mentions. There are 19 of them. It takes 19 words to describe the times in which we live. So let's start here in verse 2, 2 Timothy 3. Paul says, "For men will be lovers of themselves." That's the first thing on the list. There was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Men are lovers of themselves. We love ourselves more than we love anything or anybody else. We are egotists. That's the word. We've got big egos. Most of our major professions are associated with big egos. You think politicians have big egos? You think movie stars, rock musicians, doctors? You think lawyers get big egos? I Googled the other day professions characterized by big egos. I even found that librarians are thought to have big egos. I'm not sure I figured that one out yet, but that was in this list. Put your local librarian in the category of big egos. Elders can have big egos in the church. You don't want a man who is going to lord it over the flock. I've seen situations where elders' wives have got big egos, thinking they're more important than most folks. That's our society. Everybody thinks they are their own God. The second thing mentioned is that men will be lovers of money. You take the first two in this list, thinking you're God, being selfish, arrogant, self-righteous. You take that kind of an attitude, that kind of a character, and you couple that with the love of money, which is the root of all evil. You've got 99.5% of the reason for all the evil that we see around us in just those two things. The love of money is what drives most of our medicine. It drives our foreign policy. It drives our internal policy. It's driving the riots up in Minnesota. It's driving the entire Epstein debacle. Always follow the money to know what is really going on. The times in which we live. Number three in verse 2. Men will be boasters, self-promoters, strutting peacocks. Not only do they think they're a God, they want everybody else to think it as well. Number four, they'll be proud. Paul had to mention it twice. He starts out, men will be lovers of self, which is another way of saying men will be proud, arrogant, haughty. Just saying men are selfish, saying it once isn't enough. He's got to repeat it. Men will be blasphemers. That word means to speak against. There are men who, it doesn't matter what you say, they'll say the opposite. They're going to speak against anything you stand for, no matter how sane or rational or logical it might be. Men will be disobedient to parents. Boys, and there are a lot of that. They're mainly disobedient to parents because they've been taught their little gods. They've been taught the entire family and the rest of the world revolves around them. Their schedule's what's most important. What they want to do is more important than anything else. And so we're going to bring the rest of the family in line with what the kid wants. When I was a kid, the only rule was children need to be seen and not heard. You know, they don't really have a vote. But we've changed all that and have raised a bunch of children, several generations of children, who don't give a flip about what their parents think about anything. People are going to be unthankful. We just take everything for granted. We think it's owed us, and so we don't tip the waitress. We don't thank the person who opens the door for us or who shows us some kind of kindness. We certainly don't thank God. It's His job to provide us everything we need to get by on. After unthankful becomes unholy. There's a lot of people I know I enjoy being with. They're friendly. They're fun to be around. They make you laugh. But there is not one spiritual bone in their body. The last thing they're ever going to do is to go with you to church or have a Bible study with you. They don't want anything to do with religion. But get them away from that. They're genial people to be around. Esau, in chapter 12 of Hebrews, is going to be described as that kind of a person. They are unloving, and this is the Greek word that means without natural affection. Disobedient to parents. Dismissive of their children. Parents are too busy with their own lives to have any concern for the child's life. They are unforgiving. There are people you just cannot be at peace with. They are irreconcilable. They are impossible to get along with. And you're wasting your time trying to get to them by being nicer. By being kinder in some way. They're just not going to get along with you. They are slanderers. They easily deal in untruths and fabricate and promote untruths about others, accusations, unscrupulous in what they say, how they describe people. They're without self-control. They're reckless. They've lost control of themselves. I really like Thomas Kincaid. Yeah, everybody know Tom, the painter of light. His paintings, wonderful cottages and bridges. I really like Thomas Kincaid. Did you know he died in a bout of acute intoxication and drug use? He got to where he couldn't control his drinking. He had left his wife, was living with another woman. I think he probably used Christianity to sell his paintings because he was a lover of money. And he drank himself to death. Without self-control, men will be brutal. They will be savages in their dealings. Some of the most savage, despicable, depraved stuff that's gone on in the past generation or so is the transgender surgeries, where we stood back while sick people allowed their children to be mutilated, physically mutilated by the medical profession. You don't think that's not savage? I was very happy to see this past week that one of those children, mutilated, sued the doctors involved and got $2 million. I hope that's going to be the death knell of the savage medicine, where doctors are more into killing than healing and saving. They'll be despisers of good. People hate the police. They hate law enforcement. They will be traitors. They'll betray you. They'll pull the rug out from under you in a heartbeat. They're headstrong. That's what the clerk warned the crowd there in Ephesus who were going in to lynch Paul. You better think this over. You better not do that. They're high-minded. They are puffed up, swelled up. The picture of the times in which we live is that people are addicted to lust and they are allergic to God. Now, what are we going to do in times like this? We're going to do what the men of Hebrews 11:32 did. They put their faith in God. They trusted in God. That's how Israel got out of Egypt. They put their faith in God. They trusted in Him. The first man mentioned, Gideon, he's described as being a mighty man of the Lord by the angel there in Judges chapter 6. But Gideon didn't have a death wish. He wasn't about to take on by himself those hordes of Midianites. But God picks him to be the deliverer. And so the call goes out. We need men to stand with Gideon against the Midianites. 32,000 showed up. Now that's when you're facing an army as thick as locusts, 32,000 isn't a drop in the bucket. And God looked at the size of the army that had assembled and said, Gideon, you got too many men. Tell everybody who's scared to go on home. 22,000 left. Gideon's now got 10,000 men. God looks at that, you'd think God said, okay, now we're down to the SEAL team. Now we're down to the Green Berets. These 10,000 may not be many, but man, they can take out a lot of the enemy. No, God said, Gideon, you still got too many men. Have them all get a drink. I've been at the spot where they all went and got a drink. And the ones who raised water to their hands rather than getting their mouth down on the water, 300 drank by bringing the water up to their mouth. God says, we'll take those 300. And they don't need any weapons. They need a torch, a lamp, and a vase to stick the lamp up in. And they surrounded the Midianite camp, and when the call came, they broke the lamps, and suddenly the light all around the camp. And the Midianites in the darkness thought an army had encircled them, was ready to kill them all, and the Midianites in their rush to get out of there killed each other. And they abandoned Israel because Gideon put his trust in God. Gideon had lots of problems. He had about 70 sons by a bunch of wives. Despite all the wives, he had a mistress on the side. He got involved in some idolatrous practices later on. God doesn't mention any of that. God mentions the fact that he acted by faith. That's the answer for tough times. We're going to put our trust in God. And when we do that, we are to expect a triumph. Gideon, by his faith, delivered Israel from the Midianites. Deliverance is one of the first blessings of faith. Verse 29, Israel was delivered from Egypt by faith. Christ came and preached deliverance to the captives. Luke chapter 4. And let me read you about the deliverance from Hebrews 11 verse 33. Who through faith, by faith, subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of aliens, all because somebody said, I'm going to trust the Lord. They didn't have numbers, they didn't have weapons, they didn't have money, they had the Lord. And instead of being frightened by what they faced, they put their faith in God and He delivered them. But verse 35 we need to read. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. One of the things that faith enables us to have is to not accept deliverance. In the first century, Christians were hauled before judges for the crime of being a Christian. And they could have gotten off the hook so easily. If you were hauled in by the local police and accused of being a Christian, all you had to do to be allowed to go home was to curse the name of Christ. Or spit on His name that a legionnaire had etched in the bricks there. Or reach your hand into a bowl, get a couple of grains of incense, drop it on the fire, the censer. You're free. You can go home. But again and again and again, Christians did not accept that type of deliverance. The story is told about one legionnaire, one guard who got so exasperated with the Christian because he would not grab a little bit of incense and throw it on the fire. The Roman said, don't you know I have the power to kill you. And the Christian said, if you do, you simply take from me that which I cannot keep and give to me that which I cannot lose. And it was in their death that they found their final deliverance. We're in tough times, we're in dark times, troubled times. We're to respond in faith. And if we do, deliverance is coming, triumph is coming. We will overcome the world by our faith. We will be more than conquerors because of the love that God has in us.